Hello, and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests, two topics up for tonight. First, in a few minutes, we'll speak with Heidi Scherholz, who is with the Economic Policy Institute and is one of the co-authors of their biannual State of Working America, one of the few indispensable volumes in the economic realm. Excellent snapshot of what's going on with wages and income and jobs and income distribution and poverty and all the essential things that really matter for real people, not the abstractions of GDP or durable goods orders or all that stuff, but how people are living, their material standard of living at least. Certainly there are more dimensions to life than the material, but it's kind of hard to have a good life without at least some degree of material satisfaction. And then at the bottom of the hour, I'll speak with Mark Ames, who will be joining us in the studio. Mark was the founder, co-founder rather, of the alternative weekly, The Exile. He spent many years in Russia, The Exile, published in Moscow. He was on this show years ago with his co-editor at The Exile, Matt Taibbi. They were speaking late at night, late in the Moscow evening, live here, and extremely entertaining and enlightening, but the Exile has been harassed out of existence by the Russian government. And now Mark Ames is relocating back into the United States. So we'll talk to him about Russia, the war with Georgia, and what it's like for him to be back in the land of his birth. Before all that, just a few words on the economic news. I've been totally preoccupied with moving over the last week or 10 days, so I've hardly been following the news at all. I am, however, now a proud and happy resident of Clinton Hill in Brooklyn, so a very dramatic change from my life after almost 30 years on the Upper West Side, but no longer. New world, new life. But in any case, I'll keep these opening remarks pretty short. This week brought some news suggesting that the U.S. housing market is, as the pundits like to say, showing signs of stabilizing. And since housing has been the driving force for the economy's up and down swing over the last 5 or 6 years, that's of great potential importance. Underscore potential, of course. I probably should have used the words possibly and tentative somewhere in the last couple of sentences as well. Sales of existing houses rose by 3% in July, but the inventory of unsold houses rose slightly, so now there are over 11 months of supply on the market at the current selling pace. And the price of the average house, new house that is, or existing house that is, was down 7% from a year earlier, slightly worse than June's result. The sale of new houses picked up slightly in July as well, and the supply fell somewhat. But the average price also fell, so anyone looking for an all clear is not going to find it in this data. My guess is that we still have at least a year to go on all this. Consumer attitudes are also showing some signs of stabilizing, though you should add a healthy dollop of qualifiers to that observation as well. The Conference Board measure of consumer confidence rose in August following a small increase in July, but all of August's increase came from the expectations component, that is, people's outlook for the economic future over the next several months. Respondents' evaluation of the present actually deteriorated. Views of the job market were particularly gloomy, with a very high 32% of respondents declaring jobs hard to get. One thing affecting attitudes about the future is the decline in gas prices, which have an outsized effect on people's view of the economy. Yes, filling the tank can take a bite out of one's wallet, but energy accounts for a relatively small portion of most consumer spending. But since people do fill up the tank pretty often, it's more of a painful reminder of how hard it is to make ends meet than more crucial things like housing, healthcare, and college tuition, which are much less frequent expenditures. But with gas prices down, we're likely to see a little more economic optimism in the coming months, which could affect the presidential campaign. Now only if the job market would cooperate. Speaking of the job market, the number of first-time claims for unemployment insurance fell 10,000 last week to a still high 425,000. This indicator had been pushed higher in recent weeks by the introduction of extended unemployment benefits, an extension that happens when the job market has been in a weak trend. So this erosion is probably more the result of the waning of that anomaly rather than any improvement in the underlying tone of the job market. The fact that the figure is still above 400,000, despite that waning effect, suggests that the job market is still weak and possibly getting weaker. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about the state of working America. Thank you.
Less work for us and more by them. More work by them. And not forget the sites we go to that day by them.
And that a bit of the early Mekon single, Work All Week, which is a title with a tenuous connection to our next topic, The State of Working America. A biannual volume published by the Economic Policy Institute, and as I said in the top of the show, one of the truly indispensable volumes in the dismal science realm. It gives a view of what's going on, how the economy affects real people's lives in a way that most conventional economic indicators don't. And we're now joined by the co-author of that volume, Heidi Scherholz, who is a staff economist at the Economic Policy Institute. Welcome to Behind the News, Heidi.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's start with some news that came out earlier in the week. The Census Bureau's annual take on income and poverty reporting, average incomes up slightly last year, poverty essentially unchanged, and the number of uninsured, those people without health insurance, actually declining slightly. So what's your read of that passel of indicators?
Well, we can take those one by one. First of all, let me just talk about the insurance numbers, just to pick one. So you're absolutely right, and this is good news overall. The total number of people without health insurance in the country actually dipped down a little bit from 06 to 07. So let me just preface this by saying the numbers that came out on Tuesday are not current numbers. They are every year the Census Bureau releases their numbers for the previous year. So the changes that we're looking at here are from 06 to 07. And so one thing to keep in mind is that 07 was a peak year. That's one thing that we keep saying is this is as good as it's going to get. Things only went down after 07. 07 was the peak of the business cycle by sort of virtually all measures at this point, though it hasn't been officially declared as such. So we saw, and this is great news, the overall number of uninsured people actually ticked down between 06 and 07. But if you look drill down a little bit deeper into those numbers, what you find is that the entire increase in coverage was due to public insurance programs. The percent of the population that was covered by employer-provided insurance still continued its decline that it's been on since the year 2000. So that actually declined from 06 to 07. So the data that were released on Tuesday as far as insurance goes is consistent with this continued unraveling of the employer-provided insurance system.
That increase in the public coverage, is that the result of the population aging and more people becoming eligible for Medicare?
Exactly. It was two things. It was both ends of the age distribution. It was more kids being covered by state health insurance programs or SCHIP programs. But you're right, the bulk of it was the aging of the population, more baby boomers crossing over that 65 line so they become eligible for Medicare.
I'm counting the days till I qualify, but that's a mixed blessing. As you said earlier, that 07 was as good as it gets, at least in recent experience. It's not as good as it was in 99 and 2000.
No, exactly.
Income, despite that little rise last year, is actually still not back to 1999, 2000 levels, is it?
That's exactly right. So over the whole business cycle, from peak to peak, 2000 to 2007, we saw for the first business cycle on record, median family income, so the income that the typical family brings home, was no higher at the end of the business cycle than it was coming into it. In fact, it ticked down a little bit, a statistically insignificant amount. So the take-home message is that families their incomes have been totally stagnant over this period. And the context within which that's happening is an economy that was growing like gangbusters. Like, one of the interesting things is over this business cycle, from 2000 to 2007, productivity was growing quite strongly. It averaged 2.5% per year. So productivity, that's average output per hour, what the men and women of the American workforce produce in 1 hour. So that the the workforce is working, people are working smarter, they're working more efficiently, they're working harder. They're really making this country grow. But they just, that growth just wasn't reaching working families. The typical family didn't see any of that.
And that 2.5% number, just to put that in context, a very long-term average over about a century or more is about 2.1%. So that's substantially above the long-term average.
That's right.
And the average person saw none of that.
That's right. And so, it's, for example, in the 90s, when working people really did reap some gains, job growth was good, wages were increasing, poverty was being reduced, productivity gains were only 2% on average per year. So at that time, even though productivity wasn't as strong, working families were reaping some of those gains. But that disconnect was profound, the disconnect between overall growth in the country and working families not getting any of it was really profound in the 2000s.
Which sort of leads to the next topic, which is distribution. And a lot of the gains in that productivity went not to the average worker who was producing those gains, but managers, stockholders, the people at the top of the pyramid, right?
That's exactly right. You're right. If the country is growing and it's not going to the median worker, you know where it's going. It's going to the people at the top of the income distribution. We are really seeing unprecedented levels of income inequality. So one statistic I'll throw out there is in 2006, this is the latest these data were available, if you look at the top 1% of income earners, the richest 1%, they received 23% of all the income earned in the country. That is actually the highest level of income inequality that we've seen on record since 1928. So for literally 80 years, we haven't seen this level of inequality since sort of the robber baron days of the early 1900s. So we're seeing some pretty stark things going on in the 2000s economy.
Why is this happening?
Well,
that's a big question. We could talk for hours about that.
There's a really big question. I mean, part of it is fiscal policy. I mean, we saw tax cuts going to that were enormously tilted towards the rich that really, funneled income in that direction. We see workers right now having sort of historically low levels of bargaining power, where we see things like the minimum wage really being eroded in value. The minimum wage now is going to get it got a little boost this summer. It's going to get another little boost next summer, so that will help. But even where it's going, it's still not high end. It's still a poverty level wage. So there's a whole host of things that are combining to really reduce workers' bargaining power, which means that disconnect between overall growth and workers' wages gets wider.
And now, even though we saw GDP growth, fairly solid GDP growth through the expansion, it was not the greatest of any expansion, but it still was solid growth for 5 or 6 years. The rate of job growth was quite slow, right?
Yeah, it was remarkably slow. That's it's interesting to contrast the 90s business cycle with the 2000s, because interestingly enough, in both of those business cycles, so after the recession of the early 90s compared to after the recession of the 2000s, in both periods, after both official recessions were over, there was an extended period of joblessness where the economy continued to shed jobs even after the official recession was over. And the very important context is to keep in mind is that the labor force, the population, is expanding all the time. So just to keep up with the ever-expanding population of workers, the country has to continually add jobs. So losing jobs is a profound disservice to the workforce, because we absolutely have to add jobs just to keep up. So there was this jobless recovery after the recession of the early 90s and after the recession of the early 2000s.
But we actually had a job loss recovery for a period in the early 2000s. It wasn't just jobless.
That's right, where we were actually continued to shed jobs for almost two and a half years into the official recovery. The difference, though, in the 90s, after this jobless period, job growth just picked up like gangbusters, and we ended up with huge job growth average over the whole cycle. In comparison, over the 2000s, the sort of fantastic U.S. jobs creation machine never got really started again. So if you look over the whole cycle, jobs growth averaged 0.6% per year, which is well below what's needed to keep up with the labor force growth.
Yeah, population growth is in the neighborhood of 1%. So
that's right.
A little more than half is what's necessary.
Absolutely. And it was a third as fast. They grew a third as fast as job growth in the 90s.
So what is going on there? I mean, it does seem that employers were very reluctant to hire, and they're also very reluctant to invest in the past cycle, despite the fact that profits were very high. So why is this happening, do you think?
That's actually a fine question. What I can speak to on that is, you know, that's actually a fine question. I mean, we saw things really take off. If you look at the productivity, it's interesting. Okay, we're talking about the strong productivity growth in the 2000s, which is true. But if you look at where the productivity growth really happened, it happened from the late 90s to the mid-2000s. So that's when we saw this big burst of economic activity, and then it really did drop off. So a lot in the 2000s, which meant things were sort of winding down, you know, around about 2004, 2005, things really started to. So that boost sort of picked up the end of the 90s. You know, we rode it across the turn of the century, and then it started to fall down again. So that's why we didn't see as much growth in every area, you know, 2005, 2006, 2007.
My personal pet theory is that it's shareholder capitalism. The shareholders want maximum profits and don't want companies wasting money on things like investment and hiring.
Yeah, definitely. That's absolutely a component of this.
I'm speaking with Heidi Scherholz, who is a staff economist at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington and one of the authors of their biannual State of Working America, which comes out as a real book in January, right?
That's right. Right now we're you know, leaking out chapters at a time, but the whole volume gets released sometime in January.
Yeah, but this is a preliminary release coming into the Labor Day weekend.
That's exactly right.
And now we were earlier talking about income inequality, and now a lot of conservatives, those that will acknowledge the fact that there is a great deal of inequality, will say it's not so bad because we are a very mobile society. So, you know, we're talking about maybe all these people at the low end are just starting out or having a rough year, but things will pick up for them over the next several years. Are we really that mobile? What does the mobility picture do to the inequality?
Oh, that's interesting that you asked that, because I whenever somebody talks about inequality, I always bring up mobility. I think these two concepts go absolutely hand in hand, because you're right. You could argue that inequality isn't so bad if you know that, you know, I might be poor, but my kids have a chance to be middle class, or I know that the super rich aren't going to be snugly ensconced up there for generations. So, like, I'm sort of sympathetic to that argument that inequality is less of a problem if there's huge social mobility. But what we find is that there's a lot less social mobility in the U.S. than the sort of mythology surrounding it, the Horatio Alger stories would suggest. For example, we see a lot less social mobility in the U.S. compared to many other European countries. We do see families sort of being stuck in poverty for generations. Like, that's a real phenomenon in this country. The whole pick yourselves up by your bootstraps. If you work hard enough and if you have the, you know, the smarts, that you can do it. That mythology is just not real. I mean, it happens for sure. People do. That story is it happens for people. But the widespread of occurrence of that we sort of believe as a core value in the U.S., that isn't really borne out by the data.
And what's remarkable, too, is you alluded to this, but it's worth really worth underscoring, that we think of ourselves as a uniquely mobile society in contrast to the ossified social structures of the old world. But in fact, there's less mobility here than there is in some countries of Europe, right?
That's exactly right. We find it's actually surprising. Part of that is an artifact it comes from the fact that we have much higher levels of inequality in the U.S. than in many European countries, many peer countries around the world. The U.S. dominates as far as inequality goes.
The Russians are catching up to us, though.
Right. Well, no. Okay. So I should be very clear that if you looked at many developing countries, they are much more unequal than the United States. But when we're talking about our quote-unquote global peers, sort of advanced industrialized countries, if you narrow it to that set of countries, the U.S. dominates the inequality market. I mean, it's just we blow all these other countries out of the water. And so part of it is if you start out at the bottom, you have a really long way to go if you're in the U.S. to get up to the upper echelons. And since there's less inequality in other countries, people can move around between the sort of social strata much more easily.
And you've got a table in the report showing if you divide the population into slices of 20% each, quintiles in the jargon, people don't move very much. They might move one quintile, but that's the furthest they move. They're most likely to stay in the quintile they were in 10 years earlier, but not much likely to move more than one. So episodes of long mobility one way or the other are pretty rare.
They're absolutely rare. That's right. I mean, we have this, and it's a very important thing to keep in mind. We have this really strong idea about America that there's, people can really make it. Even if they start from nothing. And while that's true, that's possible, that it just doesn't happen that often. So there are definitely barriers that mean that, if you start out in one place, chances are that's where you're going to end up.
Part of the reason for that is that both poverty and privilege are transmissible across the generations, aren't they?
That's right. That's right. When you look parents, one way to look at this is to see how correlated your income is with your parents' income. And if your income is very correlated with your parents' income, that means there's not that much mobility, i.e., if you're poor and your parents are poor, or if you're rich and your parents are rich, there's not much mobility. And what we see is relatively high correlations between the incomes of kids and the incomes of their parents.
We were talking earlier about the contrast between the U.S. and Europe, but I would guess that one of the reasons that we have less mobility here is that the kinds of state-sponsored social democratic institutions that are more prevalent in Western Europe actually aid mobility rather than hindering it, don't they? I mean, if you have health insurance and free education or low-cost education, that makes it a lot easier to move up the ladder.
That's exactly, and you really put your finger on two really important ones. Access to really good education, really good university education, is really key to moving up the income ladder. And that's really been out of balance, out of reach for many Americans as tuition prices have increased, as state aid for tuition has been cut back. And then also the issue of health insurance is, there's the U.S. is the only industrialized country that doesn't have universal health care. It's just remarkable. And so the health insecurity that many Americans face is just not shared by their brothers and sisters across the pond. There's one more. Anyway, that I lost my train of thought there. So.
Okay, well, maybe we'll get reunited with it.
All right.
But let's we've only got a few minutes left, so let's just talk about racial and gender disparities. Any news in the last few years on those? Are they widening, narrowing, staying the same?
So the racial stuff is really pretty profound comparing the 90s to the 2000s. So what we see is more disadvantaged groups, and we know that minority populations in the U.S. are more disadvantaged economically on average. And what we see is that when the economy, when the labor market is not doing very well overall, these disadvantaged populations suffer a lot more. So we saw increased unemployment overall, but much more increase in unemployment amongst minority populations, amongst African Americans, amongst Hispanics, amongst immigrants. We also saw, as overall family incomes were stagnating, we actually see big declines in family incomes among African Americans and among Hispanics. When in comparison, in the 90s, especially in the late 90s, when things were just going like gangbusters for the low end of the income distribution, we saw huge wage gains amongst Black Americans. We saw huge decreases in poverty for Black and Hispanic Americans. So that just much of those gains were simply erased in the 2000s.
It's remarkable how what looked on paper like a mild recession and then followed by a kind of weak recovery, but it was a recovery expansion, how easily undone those gains were.
Yeah, I think it had a lot to do with the policy climate in the 2000s, this disconnect, the workers not having bargaining power, things just sort of unraveled at the low end of the income distribution. And one thing I also want to mention, you mentioned the gender, and we saw interesting stuff with gender. That one of the things that I think is important to realize about the 2000s is, in many ways, okay, so the situation for women workers, up until the 2000s, women had seen decades of gains in labor force participation rates, decades of gains in employment rates, decades of gains in wage increases, and they really kind of leveled off in the 2000s. Like, for the first time on record, women's employment rates actually declined over the 2000s, and after decades of huge increases. So what this is saying is that this economy in the 2000s was so sluggish that not only did it not bring more women into the labor force, it actually, you know, the participation rates of women actually declined over this period.
It was very strange, but it seems like the constituency that George Bush defined as his base, the have-mores, have done very well, but the rest of us haven't done so well in the last 6 or 7 years.
Yeah, that's a good summary. That's exactly what's the, you know, overall the economy grew, and it went straight to the top.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us with all this bad news.
It's the dismal science, after all.
I've been speaking with Heidi Scherholz, who is an economist at the Economic Policy Institute and one of the co-authors of their State of Working America biannual volume, released in preliminary form for Labor Day weekend, but coming out as a book in January. Let's take a break, and we'll be back.
Greetings, this is Savion Glover, and you're listening to WVAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York. Enjoy.
And this is WBAI at 99.5 in your FM dial and on the web at WBAI.org. My name is Doug Henwood, the program Behind the News. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back with Mark Ames. And that a bit of Dmitri Shostakovich's fugue number 10 in C minor for piano, C sharp minor, sorry, for piano, performed by Vladimir Ashkenazy. Soviet high culture set up here for Mark Ames, who is joining us in the studio. Mark, American by birth, but spent many years in the in Moscow, co-founder, along with Matt Taibbi, of the Exile newspaper. And you and Matt were on the show, many, many years ago in Moscow when it was late at night, and you guys sounded rather illuminated at the time. But now we got you at a more reasonable hour sitting here in the studio. So you're back after all those years in Russia. What brought you back?
Well, for one thing, the government sent in four bureaucrats to audit my newspaper's articles to see if we were offending Russian culture and Russian traditions, and if we were extremist, and if we were spreading pro-drug propaganda and pornography. And we were obviously guilty of all those things. in this day and age in Russia, it's pretty dangerous when they send in the bureaucrats after you, so yeah.
Yeah, I was reading it. You wrote this up in Radar, right? The guys in Soviet era suits sent people scurrying when they saw them. I mean, is it really that much of a holdover of the old order?
Yeah, you don't see that too much in Moscow. Most people try to look, modern or knockoff modern or whatever. But the only people that still wear these old and look like sort of old school Soviet types are government people, and particularly the bureaucrats. And part of the reason, I think, is because it really does scare the hell out of especially anybody over sort of 35 or 40, because they know that if somebody's wearing an old, an old Bolsheviki suit or outfit, I mean, they're either incredibly poor and, practically homeless, or they've got so much money that they're trying to just show this facade of not having a lot of money, but in fact they've got yachts, moored off Saint Tropez, or whatever. Because the government is so incredibly corrupt, and the average Russian has to meet with this corruption pretty much every day whenever they need to get a paper stamped, which you still need to do, for just about everything. So it's one thing though when you go to their office, but when they come into your office to audit, your editorial material, and this is obviously something that Putin personally has been pretty interested in since he took power, then it's, it's about maximally menacing.
Yes, your future is not very bright when the guys in the Soviet suits arrive. No. You were in Russia for about a decade, weren't you?
Mm.
You arrived in the Yeltsin years when everything was chaotic and impoverished and disastrous, and you left after what looks like a boom to some degree. How did things change over that 10 years?
Well, I can tell you one interesting way to track that is how the average Russians sort of saw themselves and how they behaved towards Americans. When I first arrived, Americans were definitely kind of treated like white gods, there were a lot of idiots over there. I mean, American idiots who didn't even know, what Shostakovich, let alone Shostakovich, they'd never heard of, Tolstoy or Tsar, whatever, and yet they were treated like gods by people who had, physics degrees just because they were Americans. And Russians were very self-loathing and full of just kind of Dostoevsky and self-hatred at the time, that they couldn't do anything right. And
now, is this because they lost the Cold War, or what was the root of this?
Yeah, part of it is that has always, I think, kind of historically been a part of their character anyway. It just really came to the forefront because it wasn't even just that they lost the Cold War. It was that their system turned out to be, completely inferior to the West system. And Russia's always measured itself against the West
It's always found itself lacking, though, hasn't it?
It's always thought itself superior and lacking at the same time. That's the whole kind of thing with them, and that's what makes them kind of nuts. Yeah, so, and things really changed. I would say that things changed. You would have thought that when the financial crisis hit in August 1998, 10 years ago, that they would have been pulling. In fact, we wrote about this in the Exile, that they were going to come dragging expats out of their, Western-style apartments and hanging their heads in pikes for dragging them into this disastrous privatization program so-called free market program and democracy and so on. But they didn't. What really changed them, the first time I saw it change, was when we bombed Serbia. I don't think people here quite understand it. I think they think it was some kind of, I don't know, cynical political ploy on the Russians' part. But I mean the average Russian, when they saw us bomb Serbia in 1999 over Kosovo, they saw us, and it never really kind of recovered from that, actually, as a conquering enemy.
What was this? They feel some sort of Slavic affinity with, or what?
Yeah, you know, it's strange. I don't completely understand where that myth of that tie comes from. And I'm not it's not like the average Russian every day talks about, you know, sacred Serbia or something. But
the Soviets are not shy about invading.
Yeah, they hate it. I mean, Yugoslavia and the Soviets were enemies. But whatever, you know, whether it's rational or not, the reality is they definitely believed it and felt it. I mean, my own girlfriend at the time said to me, "Are you guys going to bomb us next?" I mean, they felt actually incredibly vulnerable and angry. And then, you know, and they really did go through an incredibly humiliating decade where we were touting that whole decade as some kind of success story until the market collapse, when democracy was destroyed, the free press was destroyed. I mean, this all happened before Putin, you know, came to power. It was very violent. The economy contracted by over 60%. You know, it was a disaster. I mean, they were literally going extinct. And on top of it, their president, who was treated like patronized like a kind of semi-hero in the West, it was much more humiliating than even George Bush, put it that way. I mean, this guy was drunk half the time, genuinely drunk. And so when Putin came to power, you know, he was probably one of 10 people in Russia who's a teetotaler. And he was immediately loved, I think, you know, in part because of that. And he was such a fluent speaker. He was pretty macho. He even kind of integrated some of the some bandit sort of slang into his talk, you know, a lot of energy, tough guy, and so on. And
buff dude when he was fishing topless too, right?
Yeah, and you know, and they responded to that, and you know, as we all know, they've gotten a lot wealthier with commodities prices going through the roof.
Now, how much of that is trickling down to average Russians?
In the big cities, you really see a difference, especially in the last. Well, Moscow, you definitely see it. You know, Moscow, I remember one report said in the 90s that Moscow sucked about 85% of the nation's wealth just through Moscow, which is why Moscow is, it's not just an island. It's like a feudal, vampiric, you know, castle that just sucks off of the entire country. but there's really so much wealth now that I noticed just in the last, I don't know, 2 years, that there really is a change. I mean, you can see actually a difference, but it's so, as the expression goes, so little and so late, and the gap between Moscow and the rest of the country, or Moscow and Petersburg and the rest of the country, is just, it's huge.
I'm speaking with Mark Ames, who was one of the founders of the Exile Alternative Weekly in Moscow, back after his own exile in Russia for many, many years. Well, let's talk a little bit about Georgia. The American media, American politicians, Western politicians have been huffing and puffing and moralizing about brutal Russia and plucky, heroic Georgia. And there are a couple of aspects of this, but like, there's a headline in the Financial Times about how the West warns Russia not to get involved in Ukraine. What is the West going to do? I mean, Russia pretty much can do what it wants to at this point, can it?
I don't know. I personally think the situation right now is extremely dangerous. Because the Russians, I mean, I was just there in South Ossetia, and I was with, actually, I went on the first tour with the conquering Russian army through South Ossetia, and then into conquered Gori when they were still occupying the Georgian proper city of Gori. You know, and the city was pretty much empty, and the Russian commanders were really full of themselves and just spiking the ball in the end zone and all that, and so they think. You know, as one commander told me, they can conquer the whole world if they want to.
It's kind of a mission accomplished moment for them. Maybe.
It's the beginning, I think, is how a lot of them look at it. And they think we're weak, and we are clearly weaker than we were before. And on the other hand, you know, you have America, which is clearly in decline, and it's usually a really dangerous time, I think, when you look back in history, when a powerful country is in decline, usually that's when it gets much crazier and winds up making, you know, tripling its bets and doing a lot of really stupid things that bring on total destruction. I find this moment to be really dangerous.
Well, especially if that bellicose lunatic McCain takes office. He's really a Russia-phobe and wants to go to war on Georgia's behalf, doesn't he?
Yeah, it's really scary. And to see that he has, you know, Max Boot and Robert Kagan as his main, foreign policy advisors. And these guys have, you know, Roman Empire fantasies on their mind. And they're also looking for a new enemy, I think.
Yeah, they didn't do a rethink after the Iraq debacle.
I'm so surprised coming back here. The conventional wisdom, which they've been pushing for a while, is that actually we've already won and Iraq is already a success, case closed. You know, I don't even know how you argue with that. It's so completely insane. And that's what I mean. I mean, there's such massive delusions. You know, Americans sort of woofing and yelping. A lot of the American leaders and pundits in the Washington Post were doing a lot of whiffing and yelping about Russia over Georgia, leaving aside who really invaded whom, you know, there. But they couldn't do anything. You know, there was a real kind of cognitive dissonance moment. They were whiffing and thought that alone would kind of work. But, you know, the Russians called their bluff. And so now I think that they're stronger than they really are. They feel really aggrieved over the fact that, you know, for once, the Russians feel like they actually were on the right side of a conflict. I mean, I think most Russians, they're pretty cynical, especially these days. They usually know they're on the wrong side of things, but they were on the right side of this because the South Ossetians, who are a real minority, a beleaguered minority, who've been massacred three times, you know, over the last century by the Georgians, got attacked by Saakashvili's army. And a lot of people died, and I saw Tsinvali, and the place was destroyed. And the Russians came in and saved them. And they went farther than that, of course. But if you look at what we did, you know, in Kosovo on behalf of the Albanians and what we purport to do, you know, around the world, they were on the side of the David. They became the Goliath against Georgia, but they were on the side of the real David in this story, you know.
Yeah, Georgia gets a pretty good sympathetic coverage here. And Chakrasvili, who is a former Wall Street lawyer, right, of course, is the Western media's kind of guy. What is the actual story of Saakashvili in Georgia?
Saakashvili, I think, is a fairly interesting guy. I was there in the Rose Revolution, and he's very charismatic, but he's pretty unbalanced. And I even started hearing last year, even some neocons in state starting to say, yeah, that there's something wrong with this guy. Even like Ann Applebaum and Bruce Jackson started turning against him and realizing, you know, he's got a screw loose.
Great video of him on YouTube eating his tie.
Yeah, it almost made me feel sorry for him, except that what he's done, you know, he really believed that he could start a war and then America would come in and scare the Russians away or go to war on his behalf and secure Georgia's borders for him. So he's a really dangerous guy. And as we know, last year, there's been increasing opposition to him since the Rose Revolution, which was, you know, even though we orchestrated it, it was essentially an American-backed putsch. Nevertheless, it was on generally the right side. The Shevardnadze government was incredibly corrupt. And he did some good things, I think, in the first year. But then the usual stuff started happening, you know, shock therapy, wealth divide, starting to shut down the opposition media, et cetera, et cetera. And then last November, there were 100,000 protesters in the capital, Tbilisi, against Saakashvili. And he sent in these stormtroopers they were straight out of that video game Half-Life 2, and stomped the hell out of these people and shut down the opposition media. And now he invades a country and he gets called, you know, a Democrat. He's running around telling the media that Russia's invading him because they hate Georgia because Georgia's free and they hate Georgia because it's a democratic country. It's, I don't know, somehow Russia seemed a little bit less insane than this country, really.
Well, one of the things you did at the exile was to follow the American press there, or the Western press in Moscow, and one of your finest moments was your award to Michael Wines of the New York Times. Is this ignorance, imperial arrogance? Is this just pure self-interest? What prompts this kind of lying coverage of characters like Saakashvili?
Well, first of all, and we saw this in Russia too, he speaks English. And he speaks American English, and he speaks neocon English. And, you know, I think people...
Whereas the American correspondents don't speak Russian, right?
Well, yeah, they don't speak Russian. Right, exactly. They don't speak Russian. And the Russians, if you look at the people, particularly that have been hired in the Putin years as compared to the Yeltsin years, these guys, a lot of them, when I saw them on TV, they look like they walked right off of a James Bond villain, you know, casting or something for a villain. I mean, they really had these terrible accents and terrible outfits. And, you know, sad to say that that kind of stuff matters a lot for us. I mean, look, America, it's an isolated country that's pretty ignorant about what goes on in the world. And so we tend to identify with people who claim to or show that they identify with us. And I think that's one of the problems. And another thing, there's a lot of other stuff going on, though. What I saw when I was in North Ossetia while the war was going on, just after the ceasefire, were a bunch of reporters from big newspapers, both in England and America, and then stringers also trying to get you know, work, taking orders from their foreign desk editors back in Washington, New York, and London, looking for evidence that the Russians were lying about the war, you know, that there weren't as many killed as they had claimed, there weren't as many refugees as they had claimed, trying to minimize the Russians' story or the Ossetians' story of tragedy, and looking for all kinds of examples of massacres of Georgians or ethnic cleansing, anything to up, you know, the Georgian side of the story. And this is really being pushed from the Home Office. And so these people who take orders from their bosses go around, you know, we go through Skinvali, the capital of South Ossetia, which is destroyed, and all these people wailing and crying and showing us a hospital that was, you know, shot up, and all these places that were shot up. But we happened to pass through an ethnic Georgian village that had been burned and looted in reprisals. And, you know, but we spent most of the day in Skinvali looking at all the different districts that were destroyed. And when the journalists came back, most of them filed stories about the Ossetian the ethnic Georgian village within Ossetia that had been burned and looted, and didn't really talk much about, you know, what went on in Skinvali, because no one was interested. So, you know, it's...
Did the press people take guidance from the U.S. Embassy, or is it just their editors that tell them what to...
No, I think the editors, but also the Georgians ran a very sophisticated PR campaign. When they first invaded, I got this hysterical call from the head of a big investment bank, American investment bank in Moscow, saying, "You would not believe what is happening. The Georgians have invaded, and yet the prime minister has just did an investor call with all these top fund managers and analysts in London and Washington, about 100 of them, laying out all the talking points for the Georgian side of the story." And it was very clever. And then I got a call from a hedge fund manager here who sent me the actual memos from some of the banks about this call. Now, the prime minister, he also worked in London in investment banking, but he understood that when you get these people on your side, you know, you speak their language, you talk to them, you know, bring up the similar references about democracy and so on. And then these guys are all then going to go on CNBC or talk to, you know, people in the media as well. There's going to be kind of a cross-fertilization of the narrative between these really influential bankers and people in the media and people in power. And it worked. It was brilliant, actually.
This is a group of people that only hears what they want to hear, too. Like, they're not ones to look behind the surface.
Exactly. You know, the other thing is that, I mean, Americans always look for examples in the world of we want to see things that confirm our greatness, right? So when the Georgians talk all this BS about, you know, we're a little small democracy, we love America, we love you, please help us, that immediately appeals to people, and they're willing to overlook the fact that the Georgians have just committed their third massacre on a little ethnic minority. Whereas the Russians, I think a lot of people, particularly in the media, are still angry at Russia for failing to respond to all that neoliberal medicine in the 90s, because what the Western and American correspondents were saying in the 90s was that Russia is truly transforming into this perfect, you know, Jeffersonian Adam Smith democracy.
Well, I think they liked it when Russia was flat on its back in the 90s, and now Russia is no longer flat on its back, and they have much less freedom of maneuver, and they're annoyed.
Exactly. It's sort of like the Hollywood adage about how, you know, on your way up, you know, you see somebody on their way down and, you know, going on the way down, and don't think that you're not going to be going down one day and seeing them on their way back up. That's kind of what's happening. It's a very resentful moment for us.
Finally, you're back here in the United States now. You once wrote a piece, gained some notoriety for yourself, advocating gassing middle America. How does it feel to be back here in middle – well, we're not in middle America, but how does it feel to be back here in a land from which you were exiled for many, many years?
It's horrible. You know, it's terrifying, let me put it that way. It's terrifying, and what I think I'm going to do is try to kind of just – isolate myself as much as I can and kind of limit the amount of cultural information I take in. Otherwise, I'll wind up gassing myself.
Well, we had a minute left, but what precisely is so terrible? What strikes you as the most salient terribleness?
Just watching the Democratic Convention, for one. You know, it's just made me go and turn on the gas oven. I mean, it wasn't, you know, it's insane. It was like watching outtakes from Brian's song. It's just one blubbering, you know, I know somebody who, you know, who died of this or that. I mean, it was just, what are they talking about? This country's like in serious decline. We're almost at war. There are all kinds of people are plunged into poverty. And they're sitting there telling stories about some uncle who, you know, lost a foot somewhere. It's just insane. I don't know. I have a hard time with it.
All right, that's it. We're out of time. Thanks for joining us, Mark Ames.
Thanks for
And where can people – you're writing for Radar now? Where else are you writing?
Radar and the Nation.
Radar and the Nation. Yeah. Okay, well, uh-huh. Check it out. Great stuff. And that's it for me, Doug Henwood. And let's go out with a bit of this song by the band Leningrad, which is their Hello, Jimi Hendrix, their version of the old Soviet national anthem, which is, again, the Russian national anthem. Till next week. Bye.